Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tekumel. Okay, here we are. We're back, providing you with the best, most informative, and only TechML podcast available on the internet, the Hall of Blue Illumination, episode 6. Today we're going to talk about the Empire of the Petal Throne TSR game from 1975, and I just started an EPT game and have a few questions about the rules that my esteemed colleagues will probably be happy to answer, and hopefully at great length. With me today are James Malashevsky.
Hello.
And Victor Raymond.
Hey there.
So, in the past, when I've run a Tekumel game, I've done a lot of hand-waving with regard to the rules. And I think when I was younger, I made a common error of young game masters, perhaps, thinking that they know it all and have all the answers. And a silly game from 1975 is surely broken and outdated and shouldn't be run in favor of much better, shinier games of the present. Well, in my advancing years, I have discovered that Empire of the Petal Throne is, in fact, a wonderful game, just as it is. And I'm enjoying running it as written to the best of my ability. However, I've run into a couple of interesting, maybe vagaries within the rules that maybe we can clear up.
Only a couple?
Well, yeah. That we can clear up here, and maybe people out in the world will have more fun running Empire of the Petal Throne as a result of these vagaries being explicated. So I don't really know how to take them in order, or even if that's necessary, because there's a whole bunch of them. But I think one of the biggest ones is what is meant by hit dice in
yes.
character generation, especially with regard to the statistics. I think nowadays we're used to, in D&D style games, to have dexterity modify armor class and strength modify to hit damage rolls, etc. But this is a little bit squiffy in EPT. And James, you've been running EPT for quite a while now. How did you decide
yes.
on how it ought to be done?
This particular point or in general?
Both, maybe. Start with the present
well,
and go backwards?
Okay. So with regards to the question you have about hit dice, in that particular case, I just sort of looked at the rules as they were, and it seemed pretty clear to me that the reference to hit dice was bonuses to the hit roll. That is, the dice you use to roll to hit. So that's how I took it. I think I probably consulted even with Victor about that point, since he's often my point of contact for these arcane things about the past. And I think he confirmed that was correct. Is that not right, Victor?
Yes, actually, I would definitely go along with that. The thing about it, as far as hit dice and two hit roll and all the rest of that is concerned, is that an awful lot of the conventions that we're used to today in terms of how to refer to things weren't set in 1975.
That's right.
And so that creates a bit of a problem for the referee who's looking at the original rules, because, you know, that is one place where Phil was not, Professor Barker was not clear. It's at least by today's standards.
Yeah, I think the other thing too, if I recall correctly, it from context, it's pretty obvious what he obvious, but it becomes clearer what he means, because there are ability scores where high enough score will give you a bonus to your hit dice, and that's it. Whereas others, it will say bonus to hit dice and to damage dice. And simply by looking at that, I figured, oh, well, if it's to bonus to hit dice and to damage dice, it must mean to hit and to damage. And that's just how I went from there. I just assumed that was the case. But
well, let's take them in order. I'm actually looking at the book.
Perhaps I should get mine to take a look as well.
Mm-hmm.
Always good to have the actual text in front.
Yes.
All right.
Let's go. Anyway, here we have section 411, page 12. Strength is basically what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say strong 61 to 80, plus one on hit dice. Okay, strength mm-hmm. means an add to hit on the d20. I get that. And to hit and damage, okay, that's clear as beer as far as how I'm used to things working. Okay, intelligence. Well, this is a little different. We have 1 to 20.
Yes.
Stupid, minus 1 from both hit and damage dice. So this is not the same as how things are done nowadays. I mean, it's
but
obvious
again,
what
if
it
you
means.
Look there.
Yeah.
Yes, it is obvious what it means. It says too dumb to strike or parry properly. On this particular point, and in fact, a lot of the others will come up, I can tell you from my own, back in the 90s, I corresponded with Professor Barker about a number of things. And one of the things that has stuck with me that's not specifically Techamel related, which is game related, is that I recall very distinctly his telling me how much he disliked the idea that that characters are just sort of, you know, there were certain traits they had that made them better in one thing, but not others. He sort of felt there a more, I guess, a holistic approach to things. And I can clearly see when he says intelligence, like being a smart, clever person, you'd be good in combat too. So why not take advantage of that? Just the idea that you were simply strong, burly guy or dexterous or agility, it seemed to rub him the wrong way that wouldn't, you know, that's the sum total of what determines whether or not you're successful in combat.
That's a foreshadowing.
It makes sense.
Swords and Glory as well, with the height build strength, which is kind of an
almost certainly almost
abstract of various things. Well, so while we're on intelligence here, okay, once you get to 81 to 95, brilliant, plus one on both hit and damage dice, 40% ability to find secret doors as the character passes by them. Now, this is something, this is a bit of a lacuna or aside or whatever in the discussion, but I'm not aware that in your campaign, James, that we use this. This is like a level of detail that we may drop.
We don't. I am, how shall I say, very generous in my interpretation of the rules for finding secret doors and traps. What I tend to do rather than this specifically is to have people roll and then take into account how well they rolled and how easy it is for something to be found. But no, I don't actually use these rules as written. It is true.
Yeah, that's an example of the kind of hand waving that I've done in the past as well.
Yeah, that's true. It is true. But I think by the book, it is that characters who have ability scores below that threshold don't have the ability to find secret doors or traps. Well, unless I'm utterly mistaken.
There are some non-human races.
Yes.
The Pygmy Folk, the Paytroi,
yes.
I think the Pachi Lay, they all have the ability to do that sort of thing as well. And in that sense, I mean, it's pretty clear that Professor Barker, when he was writing this back in 1974, had taken a look at Dungeons and Dragons and said, okay, so there seem to be some things to look at here, and I want to systematize this a bit better.
Yes.
And following along from what James said, yeah, it's very easy to see that what Professor Barker was doing was saying, well, look, if you're smart, you're going to be able to find these things. And if you're not smart, you might not. You know, so there you go.
Yes.
Similarly, if you'll notice, it takes someone with real skill, or I should say real intelligence, to find, to detect traps, which suggests that, you know, if nothing else, gosh, there must be traps out there, and gosh, you want to be able to find them and stop and not get affected by them. I think the place, Scott, let me leap in here for a moment and bring us back to hit dice and so on. What's interesting here is that I think when we get to section 413, Constitution, that's where it throws people.
So here we were talking about Constitution, and my experience has led me to misinterpret the rules as written and think that Constitution modifiers had to do with changing your hit points.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's not, that's just not the case. That now you can interpret that way as a house rule, and I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. The house rule that I use in my game is that whatever the minus or bonus to hit dice is, that's your a bonus at the very end, that you roll your hit points at whatever level, and either you get a couple of more or a couple less, rather than it being the D&D convention of having...
Per hit die, yeah.
Per hit die, yeah.
That's a cool house rule.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways that it accounts for differences in Constitution without making it be a really significant effect on the differences between player characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because some of that shows up later. Remember that you have the different tables for player character hit points based on class and yes. level. So that some of that gets taken into account already. So, but yeah, I mean, I can easily see that. I mean, the business of interpreting it as it being about hit points. And I don't think it's as clear to people, because we're just not used to thinking of it this way, that if somebody is robust or someone is somehow infirm, that that might affect whether or not they could actually hit someone.
Right. Yeah, it totally makes sense. It's it just amuses me that my arrogance would lead me to believe that no, these rules are ambiguous. I know what's right, when in fact the rules are unambiguous for the time period they were written.
I also think they're only ambiguous, yeah, definitely for the time period in which they're written. I mean, if you come at it from having played D&D, I mean, it colonizes your mind in a way if you've played it for a long time. Well, no, I mean, because the thing about Empire of the Petal Throne, the difficulty for a lot of people in getting it is simply because the rules are obviously derivative of original Dungeons and Dragons, and yet at the same time, they're not identical to them. There are plenty of little changes, or even in some cases, big changes. So you think Constitution, hit dice, must be a bonus. That's the way it is even in the original D&D. So you figure it's got to be that way. I think that's, of all of the errors that you could make, I don't think that's unreasonable. It just seems to make sense, right?
So do you guys use the percentage chance of eyes not working? For example, 21 to 40 Constitution has a 40% chance. 20% chance that a healing spell or eye will not work.
Yes, I do. It doesn't come up in our Sokatis campaign because I don't think anyone has a constitution that low, at least not anymore. But I do use it in the other game I run, the Mughal Avani one, where there is a character who is quite incapable of having eyes work. Mm-hmm. So, because his constitution is so low. And that did come up, so...
Well, psychic ability, or do you still want to talk about con? That's, yeah, whatever.
Oh, well, yeah, and I also think that it's worth noting, yeah, I mean, everything that's there in terms of the chances of healing spells or eyes working, don't forget the chance of revivification.
Mm-hmm.
And also that if you have a really good constitution, those healing spells or eyes work really well, okay? So there's a bunch of modifiers here, and they don't map exactly along sort of conventional D&D lines. And so James's point about, you know, how D&D has colonized our minds, yes, that this is exactly where that's the case.
Well, yeah, it's certainly colonized mine. I've never heard it phrased exactly like that. It's a good phrase. I think I shall employ it in my own speech in the future.
Steel free.
Steel free, I will.
Well, yes.
Okay, well, psychic ability doesn't have anything that is germane to hit dice. Dexterity does.
Yes, it does.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, well, now that it's to be understood that hit dice has to do with to hit pretty much always in these tables, then it makes much more sense. And this notion of the house rule of adding a little bit to hit points once you total up all the dice, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I only do it with Constitution. I don't do it with the other ones. I just simply say, you know, there you go. And maybe that's too much of a gimme back to D&D, but you know,
it's a cool gimme. I mean, giving player characters a little bit more robustness, I think, is a good idea. Mm-hmm. So that takes us to skills.
Yes,
Victor and I had it. No,
not. I want to go back for a moment because it's an interesting point and people may not realize this. Unless you've picked up a copy of the what we refer to as the Mimeo EPT, the original playtest rules that Professor Barker put together, you would not know that comeliness, the sixth characteristic, was not an original part of the game.
Indeed.
That comeliness was added later. After players had been playing for a while, there had originally been five characteristics, and that was it. And so comeliness was an add, mostly because I believe that Professor Barker did not think that charisma was a quality that ought to be a character abstraction, that he felt that charisma would emerge from gameplay. If you were a heroic character, you know, if you played your character heroically, then you would naturally gain bonuses from your interactions with others. Whereas, you know, if you were your usual player character, why should you get rewarded for your character being somehow more, you know, charismatic in that sense? He felt that it was a difficult thing to measure in the first place. And so instead, he said, well, we can, however, look at how someone looks and say, are they good looking? Are they ugly? And we'll use that. And that's something that he felt was more easily measured for the purposes of gameplay. And I think it eliminated for him a sort of quandary about how do you actually play these things? I mean, this usually comes up in the context of a D&D discussion where you have players saying, well, I'm playing a really smart magic user, but I'm not that smart. What do I do? Or conversely, gosh, my character is so dumb. How do I roleplay that?
Mm.
Well, I'm glad we didn't skip comeliness, because that is a very interesting aside. I had no idea. And with regard to, it says in the EPT book, it says, denotes the relative beauty or handsomeness of a character. And in later rule sense, I think that's further explicated to say, vis-a-vis the cultural standards of the being that is being evaluated for comeliness.
It even says that in EPT, actually.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it does. When it talks about someone being very good-looking, it specifies according to...
Oh, here we go.
Soljani's stand.
Yeah.
And you know, mind you, this has led to no small number of role-playing opportunities when someone gets lucky here. The character turns heads when met on the street, attracts offers of marriage or other forms of union. The character in the 96 to 100, wildly handsome, gloriously lovely. The character is so beautiful or handsome that care must be taken to avoid being stolen by slavers, carried off by various religious groups for participation in orgies, etc. This classification is thus a mixed blessing. And if a referee cannot glean some adventure opportunities out of that, they're just not trying.
Yeah, you could get a whole plot arc going about this. Carried off by various religious groups.
There he is. We see him again. Go. Get him now. We must the high priest says that we must participate. You know.
Okay, now do you want to talk about skills?
Sure.
Okay. All right, so here I am again with my... I have beef. I have... Do I have sea eel or come on if I have beef? I don't know.
You know, actually... There is no easy parallel there. You know, Chma and Chmelu are the Tekemelani sort of analogs of sheep. And
how about Se'il?
Se'il, bear, maybe?
Bear. I have bear. I have bear with the skills.
Okay, well, all right then. I'm at a loss, so there's no beef equivalent.
Not really, no.
Well, I'll just stick with I have sea eel with skills. Okay, so here's the thing. If a prospective GM runs the Fresh Off the Boat game, which we discussed in episode one, then how do you reconcile the skills in section 420, which seem to be Sol'jani skills, with unlettered barbarians from somewhere else?
Well, I mean, I think you're making an assumption there. You say unlettered barbarians. That isn't necessarily true. It just means they're not Sol'jani.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that's what I always assume. I mean, if I ran for a group of players and they were interested in playing that kind of a thing, people who are genuinely barbaric, sort of primitive people, that's fine. And there's plenty of ways to make that work. But I always took Fresh Off the Boat simply to mean that you are barbarian in the sense that you are not Sol'jani.
That is exactly what I did for this new campaign. And it's a perfectly civilized foreign nation.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily, you know, brush dwellers.
No.
I should note that perhaps to the Sol'jani, the concept of civilized and foreign nation might be considered something of a oxymoron. But that having been said, yeah. I think what we're seeing here in section 420 is Professor Barker wanting a system that gives characters some background, but not wanting to go so very deep that it's really region and culture specific. It is, in other words, a gloss.
Mm-hmm.
It is a way to both gain some sense of what a character's original status and background were before arriving in Sol'jani, as well as also being useful for generating characters that are from Sol'jani, you know, because you can just roll and the dice rolls are sufficiently, how would I put this? Not vague so much as they are sufficiently broadly constructed as to allow anyone to generate a character off of this without having to be specific about, well, where are you from or what is your race or, you know, what exactly is your clan. And so in Swords and Glory later on, you see this, well, we're going to get down to exactly where you're from and exactly what clan you belong to. And the skills that you develop are actually probably more dependent on that background than they are on just some sort of role here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, my own interpretation of Section 420, and again, this is something of a house rule, is I just simply take the role to say, this is a role to indicate your relative status where you are from. Okay? And it's up to you as the player to construct that, which is to say, if you roll really badly, well, you know, maybe you're from a low clan and, you know, of moderate lineage, if someone wants to get that specific. Or maybe they're from a very low clan and they're a very high lineage within that clan. But rather than getting that specific, it's just a die roll to give you an idea, and you can take it from there. It gives you enough information for you to have an idea, but doesn't get so specific as to make it, you know, how would one put this, a section off your census form.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that topic, it seems like the skills are socially, vertically grouped.
Yes.
So, you know, plebeian, skilled, and noble. So if I roll a high number on the table, I get numerous skills from each group. Uh-huh. And I've had a little trouble kind of massaging the narrative to explain why somebody can have rarefied noble skills but also have plebeian skills.
Ah, hobbyist skills. That, I mean, and again, you know, looking forward to Swords and Glory, you can see kind of how these things got explicated further. Professor Barker goes into some detail to talk about how people from who are taking skills from a noble background, skills that seem to be somewhat, as you say, plebeian, well, they're essentially hobbyists at it. Oh, yes, you know, I've always wanted to be a farmer. Well, mm-hmm. I am a gentleman farmer then. When I am out at the clan's villa in the rural countryside, I, you know, go about, you know, the necessity of cultivating crops and learning from the folk there in a way that allows me to have some skill. Mm-hmm. Is that not noble of me?
Indeed. No, that's a very good way of putting it.
I can imagine the reception that this individual may experience. I don't know. Could vary on the personality of the. Does he think he knows a lot about farming? Is he really there to learn? Is he trying to tell everyone what to do, but really knows very little about farming?
Well, you know, and there's some of that. I mean, one of the things about this is that, and this is a case of, again, I think Professor Barker started off with something as a way to explore this topic. But didn't necessarily think that it needed an awful lot of explanation. So there is the skill system in Empire of the Petal Throne. It's baked in. The skill system is that when you're at first level, you've got about a 40% chance, 40 or 45% chance, I can't remember right off the top of my head, of being able to do, you know, to successfully perform one of these skills. And that role can be modified by circumstances and other factors, okay? And as you go up levels, you gain another 5% in the skills that you have. And I think that in a very real way, this presages, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons non-weapon proficiencies.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Where is the skill percentage, like success?
It's the same as the spells.
Is it?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, see, this is something that I am glad to know.
Yeah, because it's mentioned in a couple places, but I think the first place it comes up is in discussion of alchemy, of the alchemist. It says that the chance is governed by the chance of spell working table in section 434. So I just go ahead and use that. I think that's what you're supposed to do. That's what I do.
That is, in fact, precisely what you're supposed to do. Similarly, let's see here. If you're a botanist can recognize edible or poisonous plant species and other characteristics of Tecamel's flora. Similarly, geologists can recognize minerals in their raw states. That's when you're doing that gold mining or ruby mining. This is what you need. And success for both of those skills is determined, again, from the chances of spell working, chances of spells working table.
Well, yeah. So. Another thing that I do, and this is sort of my own interpretation and a sort of a house rule, is that in the discussion of the assassin spy tracker skill, for example, it says the tracking depends on, you know, the table, the same one that we're talking about, but it'll also partially depend upon dexterity and intelligence. What I have done in the past is I have just transposed the dexterity and intelligence values to the psychic ability chart. And where it gives bonuses to spells working,
I use that partially to add to the chance to succeed in certain other things where it's appropriate, right? So if you have a 61 to 80 dexterity, it would give you a plus 5% chance as an assassin spy tracker to like sneak around or whatever. You know, I just like to have the ability scores occasionally have influence, and it says you're supposed to do that, but it doesn't tell you how. So,
well, that all makes perfect sense. So this is a related question. So how do you guys do what we would call nowadays ability checks?
Well, there's two ways. I mean, there's just a straight way. You can just roll straight under an appropriate ability score if you think that's pertinent. But there actually is in the rules themselves, I just can't remember where it's actually talked about, a way to go about doing that. Where is that? It is the...
Section 725.
Right. There you go. Because that gives you a what they call an adventure roll or something. I forget what they call it. 725. Just a generalized task roll, sort of. It's the average of a character's strength, intelligence, and dexterity added together and then divided, you know, averaged. So that's all those things.
Yes. Well, that's what I've been doing just sort of intuitively. So it's interesting to see that here it is.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with that in place, it would be very easy in certain circumstances if you think that different ability scores come to bear to add and average those. If you don't think a single one or those three particular ones. You know, we've got percentile ability scores, so that's really easy to use, I think, in play if you want.
I would say that, for example, what you could end up doing, I mean, by using strength, intelligence, and dexterity, you've got a roll that you can use for any physical task that comes along. Well, make a roll and see how you do. And in so doing, it means that it's less about any one characteristic, as James was talking about earlier, and more about, you know, so what's the sum total of the person? What does this all add up to? I think that under specific circumstances, you can use specific characteristics. But really, I mean, you've got a skill system and you have a way to resolve checks against general tasks that are physical or, you know, in some way mental, and are tasks requiring arduous physical or mental action.
Yes.
Yeah, there it is, right there.
Yeah.
Well, so this is, while we're on Section 25, or Section 725, nobody does 10-minute combat rounds. That's Section 24. I mean, have you ever experimented with that? Or 1-minute combat rounds?
Oh, sure.
That's more or less, I think. I mean...
That's
Wait. My mind is blown. Okay, so...
Really?
Yeah, I've just done like 6 to 10 second combat rounds forever. And...
Really?
Yeah, and... But all this time in your game, I should be assuming that the combat rounds are a minute each.
Well, yeah, because that's the way that, I mean, the spell system works that way in terms of how long spells last and so forth, right? It assumes minutes and so forth, because otherwise the spells last a really long time, some of them.
Can I give a bit of an explanation as to why combat rounds are a minute long?
Sure, yeah. Is it like the D&D explanation?
Well, it's kind of. I think it's important to remember that Professor Barker, like Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, had a background in miniatures wargaming.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that both Dungeons & Dragons and Empire of the Petal Throne, to some extent, derive from that experience of miniatures wargaming. And when you look at combat at that scale, you know, particularly take a game like Chainmail, where each individual figure represents 20 men-at-arms. Okay? And a turn for the purposes of determining what happens to those 20 guys is 10 minutes long. Okay? So for these original authors, combat was still considered abstract, just like the chainmail level of combat was abstract. It was just on a somewhat smaller scale. So for them, it wasn't a matter of saying, well, what does my guy do in the next 10 seconds? And there's a lot that can go on. That's a very individual scale. They didn't think of it that way. What they thought of it as is, well, I'm used to thinking about armies made up of 30 or 40 or 100 or more figures, each of them representing 20 warriors, okay, or soldiers, and each turn representing 10 minutes of time, that when I get down to one person, then I'm going to make the combat round 1 minute, and that's still abstract, but it's abstract in a way that allows for a much more accelerated combat than if it were the larger miniatures.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. There's a good discussion about that in the original Dungeon Master's Guide as well.
Yeah. But oh, yeah, absolutely.
This is one of the examples where just I assumed I wanted to do things my way, which was short, more narrative-oriented combat rounds where you're more getting into the nitty-gritty of who does what when. But it changes how everything's narrated by having a minute-long combat round. I'm trying to wrap my head around how you would... It'd be kind of like a meta description of how the tide of the battle goes rather than anything particular.
I think that's right.
That's quite right, yeah.
I don't think you can do it. It's not. I don't think the combat was intended to be a blow-by-blow sort of a thing, right? A combat roll represents a series of different movements in a combat rather than just a single attack.
Well, my pre-existing point of view as a younger person, and maybe even within the last 10 minutes, has made me think that a combat round this long wouldn't be very fun to narrate, and it would just kind of be abstracted with, I roll, you roll, okay, apply damage, move on. But it seems like you could make it interesting somehow. It's almost like a game within the game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, actually, Gary goes into some length explaining all of this in a column in the Sorcerer's Scroll in the Dragon magazine. I think it's like number 20. I mean, I have to go back and look. I probably have the number wrong. But Gary talks about this at some length in detail. And also, for example, by the way, because of this system, that's why you don't have hit location.
Yeah. Maybe RuneQuest poisoned my mind when I was... 9.
It's poisoned a lot of people's minds.
It's true.
Wait, what's the phrase? It's colonized my mind.
Colonized
your mind. Yeah, your imagination, yeah.
There's an interesting point in here in the combat round that gets forgotten about, and I run across this with my players frequently, and it says combat rounds are fought in pairs. One round for the attacker, the winner of the reaction time throw, and one for the defender. Thus, if the defender is slain during the attacker's round, he still gets a chance to strike a dying blow on his last round.
Correct.
Yes.
Because the round's not over till it's over.
Correct. And exactly. in your defense, Scott, I was going to say, I just checked because I didn't know the answer to this, but in Swords and Glory, a combat round is 6 seconds.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a lot more granular of a system, too.
It is indeed. But, so, you've said you played Swords and Glory, or at least some version thereof when you were a younger person.
So. I ran Swords and Glory as close to the book as I could manage it for about 6 months. And it was pretty fun while I was busy kind of woodshedding on the rules. But I think it would be hard to do nowadays.
I don't know. I think James and I have talked about this some before, that the one of the things going on here is that you've got not only Swords and Glory, but Gardasial. Between the two of them, you have more than enough to run a game using those rules, you know, along with the Bestiary. And I don't see any reason why you couldn't make that work.
It would totally work. You just have to find people who want to do it.
There's enough people, I think, who want that kind of granularity that it's something that people could do. I know that there's some people who think that that's, it's too much bother, but it depends on what you want to emphasize in the game that you're running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was really fun. I like to have that amount of detail.
Sure.
Okay, so what have we talked about? We talked about the initial stats. We talked about skills. We talked about combat a little. Those were really
some of the other questions you had.
Well, those are the main things that I've run into so far. So this has been very instructional.
Good.
Yeah.
Let me see here. There, as we're going along here, we're going to get into, if we want to continue talking about some of this stuff, we could talk about some differences in another session here, talking about how combat is conducted, what do hit points actually do, and all the rest of that.
I think that we have a good amount of content for this episode.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And maybe we could continue to talk about the EPT rules for a few episodes.
That's fine.
I think I'm a fan of the setting, but EPT itself I have very little experience with. There's probably a lot of people in that boat, like the guys in my new game have very little EPT experience, but they're big fans of the setting.
Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting here, when looking at the gods, cohorts, and divine intervention, this section here, is that this is a massive add-on to the sort of basic structure of D&D that doesn't get explored in D&D until we get gods, demigods, and heroes. Mm-hmm. But here we have the name of the god, the nature of the god, what they're about, and also a little bit about their priesthoods and how they are represented and symbolized.
Yes.
So this is like a lot of info. What's kind of unfortunate about this is that there isn't an awful lot of info about temples and hierarchies, and that gets resolved later with Professor Barker's article on the Temple of Thumis. But, okay, let's talk about how to pronounce the names of the gods. Okay, so if you look at the very first one, the Tlumitlanyal, that is to say the gods, the good gods, right? And that's Tlumitlanyal. The stress is on the M-I-T, accent on the I. And the Tlokirikaluyal, and that's the evil gods, or in this case, the gods of change. And the cohorts are the Tlemekluyal. Okay? And I'm drawing those words out so people understand. Tlemekluyal. Okay? And so the first god of the gods of stability, what are listed as the good gods in Empire of the Petal Throne, is Thnala. Thnala. And that's that H gets a little aspiration, and N-A with the accent, L-L-A, Thnala.
And right. Thnala's attribution is the supreme principle of good, the Lord whose name may not be known, master of light and foe of evil.
Mm-hmm. And then after that you have Karakhan. Karakhan, the Lord of War, Master of Heroes, the ultimate warrior on the final day.
Wow. That is awesome.
Yes. Very, very apocalyptic, right?
Yeah.
And again, people have picked up, there seems to be a little suggestion of Horus, the young god, here in his depiction.
Oh, yeah. Head rather and like that of a hawk.
Yes. And then you have Thumis. Thumis. And actually, if we want to be precise, that I would be have a little bit more of an E sound to it. Thumis.
Yeah, that's how Thumis. I do it.
Yeah. I think some of the names got elided over time in play of Professor Barker's game. So, Thumis, the Lord of Wisdom, the Knower of Arts, Hidden Seeker of Eternal Knowledge, the Sage of the Gods. Yes. Yeah, a very, very interesting god. And in fact, one that Professor Barker, I thought it was very interesting that he picked Thumis as the god to explore first when he was writing his articles about the gods. And then you have Avante. Avante. Okay. And the accents are over that second A. Avante. The mistress of heaven, maiden of beauty, mother of devotion, wife to Nala. And so, yes, Avante is a god, a goddess of fertility and maternity and family, hearth, home, all of that. And then the last god of the good gods, the gods of stability, is Belcanu. Belcanu. And Belcanu is the lord of the excellent dead, the master of the paradises of Teretane, the opener of the gates of heaven. And Belcanu is interesting as a god because while his ambit, his area of influence involves the dead, right? It also involves the myriad planes beyond.
Hmm.
Okay.
I hear the name of this god a little differently. I hear it as Belcanu, like a Belcanu.
That's actually probably that's probably even closer. Yeah. As I'm looking at you want to be careful about making it, it's not Kanu, you know, that sort of ka ka sound. It's Kanu, that K-H-A, Kanu, Belcanu. Yeah. And we'll explore that the influence of consonant groupings later when we talk about the Lord of Red Devastation and how to pronounce his name.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, Belcanu. Yeah. And it's worth noting, and it's the one thing that I think players and referees, including me, do not pay enough attention to, is at the very end of the book, there is the section on how to pronounce things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where I went first. I always thought that was fascinating.
Yes, the KH sound is the K of German Ach or Scots Loch. It's a voiceless velar fricative. Okay.
I love gaming because you learn the strangest words.
Yeah.
For example, like if you're 11 years old and you come across fricative, you're like, what
fricative? Leave those labial fricatives out of here. But there's this great note under this. Look at this here. This is actually kind of cool. And this is indicative of just how much he was thinking about this, is that in most Soliani dialects, all aspirated Ks have become kha. Buck. The contrast is maintained only in a few Mukhlaviani loan words under K above. So that's there's
interesting. So it is Belcanu then.
Belcanu.
Well no, but it says the aspiration hasn't been maintained in most
In only a few Mukhlaviani loan words. Okay. The aspirate K of the English cool. Notice that that's not lock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think we get confused because there's this CH notation, which is the CH of church or cheese, right? And so the K of skin, kin, cool, which occurs in a few Mukhlaviani loan words in Soliani. Now, what does Professor Barker not do? He does not give us the examples of those Mukhlaviani loanwords. Grr.
Well, he didn't want to overload us with detail, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, so that's our Soliani lesson of the day, as it were, of the podcast.
Hooray!
We have the gods here, the five gods, Nala, Karakan, Thumis, Avanthe, and Belkhanu.
Well, maybe next time we can do the gods of evil.
Please, the gods of change.
We can talk about the difference between stability and change and good and evil next time, maybe. It seems germane to any discussion of the gods to bring that up.
Sure.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find TechML Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of TechML.